From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Neonatal intensive care has advanced significantly in the past generation. It's a hallmark of what can feel like the miracles of modern medicine. But at the same time, the rates of premature birth in the U.S. have not gone down. This country has one of the highest rates of premature birth in the industrialized world. So why is that? And what can we do to make sure that more infants are not born too early? So this hour On Point, the history and future of premature birth. And you can join us. We want to hear from you if this is your story. If you had a child who was born prematurely, what was the hospital experience like? And what access to care did you have for your child after you left the hospital? Did you get the help you needed or not? And for clinicians out there, what do you think we should be doing more of to reduce the rates of premature birth? Well, Sarah DiGregorio joins us today to talk about this issue because she's been through it firsthand. And that's the reason why she decided to dive deeply into the issue of premature birth. Her new book is Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. Sarah DiGregorio, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. I was hoping that you might be able to just start with your own story and
Sure. And
the birth of your daughter. How far along were you in your pregnancy when she was born?
Yes, I was 28 weeks along. I was at the end of my 28th week of pregnancy. And so in that respect, we were very lucky. What happened was that at 12 weeks, I had had an abnormal test result, which indicated very low PAPA, which is a protein that the placenta is supposed to make. Mm. And so that sort of flagged things for our OB to that put us at risk of things like growth restriction and premature birth. So I was getting growth scans to make sure that the placenta was still working and that my daughter was still growing. And on the first day of my 28th week, I got this scan. It was right before Thanksgiving. And I knew when I saw the technician's face that something wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so it was true that the placenta was failing. And my daughter had fallen off the growth curve and she was below the first percentile. And what that meant was that we had to go straight to the hospital. I was lucky that we had this heads up. So I was mm-hmm. able to get two steroid shots, which are very important for improving outcomes. And then several days later, she was born in an emergency C-section. And she weighed 1 pound, 13 ounces, which
wow.
is below the average for that gestation. And that was the problem.
1 pound?
So,
I mean, tiny.
Yeah. Yeah, very tiny. And it, you know, seeing a baby that small who needs life support for every vital function. When she was born, she was on a ventilator. She was in an incubator. At first, she was on intravenous nutrition, and then she had a feeding tube after that. You know, in all these things, we were very, very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, it was a very acute situation. Being introduced to parenthood in an ICU setting is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
It was really very amazing to be able to see the progression of the way that to be able to see a baby go from 1 pound, 13 ounces, and she lost weight at first and went down to 1.5 pounds. And then to see her sort of become herself in that context of the ICU was brought up a lot of questions for me. So that was, you know,
Yeah. That
was our introduction to premature birth.
Well, we're going to explore some of those questions throughout this hour. But just, Sarah, if I may, how long was your daughter in the NICU?
She was in the NICU for 2 months.
Okay.
And she, you know, she really did very well. What I had was called unexplained placental insufficiency, which is just a fancy way of saying that we don't know what happened. The placenta didn't work right. And so as a result, she had intrauterine growth restrictions. So,
uh-huh.
you know, that can be associated with a lot of different complications because the fetus is in an adverse environment in the uterus.
Yeah.
I always said I was a really well-fed food editor and my fetus was starving.
Oh, dear.
but not that it's funny, but it was highly ironic to me.
Yeah.
So she was in the NICU for 2 months.
And when she went home, how how much did she weigh? And obviously she was well mm-hmm. enough to go home, right?
Right. So in order for premature babies to go home, and this was the case for her as well, usually they have to be about 4 pounds. They have to be about 37 weeks gestation. Sometimes they can go home a little bit earlier than that. They have to be able to breathe on their own. Their hearts have to keep beating on their own. So, you know, we have all these hurdles, these developmental hurdles to go through. So, yes, when she was discharged, she was 36 weeks gestation and about 4 pounds. Mm-hmm. And going home, I think a lot of parents experience the NICU is very, very difficult. And especially, you know, when you're dealing with postpartum hormones, I think that's not easy for anybody. When you experience those things in an intensive care setting, it can be very, very difficult for your mental health.
Yeah.
But going home, and everyone, you know, really looks forward to going home. Going home can be a very difficult transition as well, because you're used to having heart rate and pulse ox, the level of oxygen in their blood. You're used to this battalion of, you know, monitoring that mm-hmm. happens in the NICU. And then you take the baby home and, you know, you really have to be able to trust your own eyes. You have to be able to trust that you know how to take care of that baby. Very difficult.
I was just going to say, in the best of circumstances, with a completely normal labor and delivery, there's still that terror when you go home. Like, what am I going to do now? And and on top of that, having you know, all the concerns that you have with a prematurely born child. I mean, I can't even imagine how terrifying that is.
There's one thing that really struck me was in the NICU, it's quite common. Almost every premature baby has either apnea of prematurity or bradycardia of prematurity or both. And that basically means that their brain stems are not quite up and running yet. And they have these episodes where their heart will slowly just sort of almost come to a stop, or they will just stop breathing. And because they're being monitored in the NICU, the nurse will notice, or the parent will notice, and they'll come over and they just sort of need like a little pat to get going mm-hmm. again, usually. And when you bring them home, you know, they say, well, just watch their skin color. And they don't release them if they think that this is going to be a big problem. But it is this thing where you're like, you know, every parent, I think, says, oh, God, are they still breathing? Are they still breathing? But when you've been in the NICU, you're like, oh, my God, are they still breathing?
Yeah.
It's a real serious concern.
So there's so much to talk about with you, Sarah. But I want to actually just for a second go backwards a little bit, because, I mean, even just what you described in terms of the medical care that's available today in a NICU, all that constant monitoring, et cetera, so dramatically different than what even in your own family previous generations experienced, right?
Yes. So premature birth has always happened. It hasn't always been considered a medical problem with medical solutions, but of course babies have always been born early. And throughout history, midwives and parents have sort of come up with ways to keep too small baby, you know, babies that are too small, to keep them warm. And my grandfather was one of twins. He was born in 1921, and he was very premature. My great aunt remembers that he was maybe about a pound and a half. They were a pound and a half each. And my great grandmother, they were born at home. My great grandmother was an immigrant from Italy, and she kept them. She wrapped them in cotton and kept them in a very low oven. And that was quite common, actually. That was a solution that women had come up with throughout history. There are lots of examples of that, different ways that people came up with to try to keep these babies alive.
Oh, that, I mean, to me, that's jaw-dropping. But not jaw-dropping is the extent that a parent will go to try to save their child's life. I mean, that is the heart of this story here. So tell us then about, okay, so just in this, the issue of incubation, how did that come about as being, you know, a de facto standard in the care for premature infants?
Yeah, the history of incubation is so interesting. It's very, very long and winding, and it has a lot of detours. What happened was there was a doctor named Stéphane Tarnier. He was a doctor at the maternity hospital in Paris in the 1880s. And the story goes that he went to the Paris Zoo one day, and he had been bothered by the very high mortality rate that the most underweight babies had in his hospital. So this was something that he had been thinking about. And apparently that day he was looking at a poultry egg warmer, which was something that had been used for thousands of years. I think the Egyptians actually came up with it, but basically a way to hatch poultry eggs. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at that and he thought to himself, well, what would happen if I put a baby inside there? That would keep them warmer than what we do normally, which was really just to wrap them up in flannel. So he asked his friend, who was the head of the Paris Zoo, to sort of come up with a prototype for him. And he started using it. He started using it around, I think it was 1883. And immediately, survival rates jumped up. Previously, he had had something like 30% of babies born around 4 pounds, something like 30% of them survived, I'm sorry. And then when he started using the incubator, 60% of them survived.
Wow.
So immediately it was obvious. And, you know, his incubator at the time, the first one that he used was a hot water tank on the bottom and then an area for a baby on top. And so it wasn't very, very different from what, you know, parents and midwives had sort of been rigging up for centuries. But what he did was really bring it into the realm of the idea of the medical and sort of testing its effectiveness and disseminating that idea that, hey, this is something that has a really measurable effect. And we should be doing more of this. And from there, it spread around Europe.
Yeah. Well, we are talking this hour about the history and future of premature birth. When we come back, we're going to take a look at really the different rates of premature birth across groups here in the United States, and also why overall the U.S. has an unacceptably high rate of premature birth. And we're going to hear your stories as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about premature births in the United States, and I'm joined today by Sarah DiGregorio. She's author of the new book, Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. And in just a minute, we're going to hear from a clinician in Mississippi. But Sarah, we'll dip in and out of the history over the course of this conversation. But I did want to sort of just get to something head on here. I mean, how high is the rate of premature birth in the United States? And does it compare unfavorably to other industrialized nations?
Yes, definitely. It's just over 10%, and it's been rising for the last 4 years. So it is the highest in the industrialized world, and it is the second leading cause of infant mortality in the U.S. and worldwide. So it is a major public health issue, and it is quite high in the United States.
10% is a lot. And, of course, we have major disparities then
within
that 10%.
Mm-hmm. One of the biggest problems that we have in the United States is that we have a very problematic racial disparity in rates of premature birth. So black women in America are 50% more likely to give birth early than all other women.
That is such a shocking number. I mean, I've heard it before, but like it doesn't lose its unacceptability. So
yes.
Sarah, hang on here for a second, because that's exactly why we want to turn now to Dr. Charlene Collier. She joins us from Jackson, Mississippi. She's an OBGYN and associate professor at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And Dr. Collier is also director of the Mississippi Perinatal Quality Collaborative. So, Dr. Collier, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Megan. Thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you. I was wondering if you could start by sort of taking us, like if we were just one of your students on your rounds, for example. And what is it that you see amongst the families that you serve and premature births?
Sure. So I split my time between working with the State Department of Health and being a clinician in OBGYN, a general OBGYN at the University of Mississippi. And when I'm working clinically, it feels like there's a wave rushing in that we're having a really hard time stopping. The mothers coming in, particularly with preeclampsia, is what we're seeing extremely high rates of. It's just a constant presence on our labor floor and something where you feel like you're providing medical care in that instant to try to deal with these issues, but we're not really getting at what's driving it on the outside, what's bringing moms in. So we're seeing preterm labor or preterm rupture of membranes, which is one of the most common causes, where for various reasons, moms just come in labor early, and we have some medications that tend to, and technologies to try to stop that, but often once labor's really going, we're not that effective at getting it to stop. And then when it comes to conditions like preeclampsia, are also not very good at getting those conditions to stop the course once they're started. So once a woman is in the hospital, preventing that preterm birth becomes very difficult. So we're always trying to think, we need to start thinking more about what's happening even before a woman's pregnant to try to prevent these conditions from starting in the first place.
So, because this is the thing about preterm birth, right? I mean, it's 100% linked to the health and well-being of mom, right?
Absolutely.
And that issue goes back before even pregnancy. So for African American women here, what's going on? Why that number that Sarah gave us, the 50% higher rate? What do we know? What's driving that?
Well, I think there's no way to start the conversation without focusing on racism. I mean, there's no doubt about the history of racism in our country, and there's never been a full response to deal with those effects on the health of women or any of our healthcare systems. So there isn't a biological basis for that difference, and that has to be put to rest immediately, because many people hear that statistic and begin to think there's something inherently wrong with black women or inherently wrong with what black mothers do, and that is not true, and I can absolutely say that. In clinical care, black women want to have their babies on time. They do everything we ask of them to do in terms of caring for themselves, and yet we still see these outcomes, and that really comes down to how racism, implicit bias, and explicit biases are deeply ingrained in our healthcare system, and we have not done enough to dismantle that and deal with those effects. And so we're really seeing it come to fruition in the preterm birth rate. We can have excellent technology in our NICUs. We can provide excellent medical care, but medical care is not what's going to fix this in our country. We really have to start looking at the women's entire lived experience, and that starts from birth and childhood, the neighborhood she grows up in, the type of environment she's living in, the education she has access to, and it's not enough to think a single pill or medical intervention is going to fix that.
Right.
But yeah, so it's a major challenge.
Well, Sarah, do you want to add to what Dr. Collier is saying?
I think it's really powerful to hear that from Dr. Collier. It's what I've heard from a lot of clinicians and researchers that I've interviewed. As she said, preterm birth is an outcome that has a lot of – it's multifactorial. It happens for a lot of different reasons. But if we really want to understand why the United States struggles with this so much, we really should start with racism and sort of the many, many ways that impacts women's health. I wanted to bring up the research. Dr. Collier mentioned that, you know, talking about these statistics, you do run into – you run the risk of making people think that there's some kind of innate problem when that is absolutely not true, that this is really an environmental issue. And one thing that I have found very helpful in terms of explaining this to lay people is, first of all, that this this risk for Black women cuts across all economic lines and all education lines. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, for white women gaining access, you know, having higher incomes and gaining access to more resources generally makes birth outcomes better, and it doesn't work the same way for Black women. And I have also found it very useful to speak about Dr. James Collins' research. He's looked at premature birth from an epidemiological standpoint, looking at populations. He's been doing it since the 90s. And I find this research really devastating. He has looked at immigrants to the United States. Black women immigrants to the United States have comparable birth outcomes to white American women. But those immigrants' daughters who are born in the United States have the higher risk. So what that suggests is that there's nothing innate, there's nothing genetic going on. It's an environmental issue. And just thinking about why immigrants come to this country with a hope of a better life, and I find his research devastating. To think about then the daughters of those immigrants having worse birth outcomes than their mothers.
Well, Dr. Collier, let's talk a little bit more about what the work that you're doing in Mississippi itself here. So, I mean, the Mississippi Perinatal Quality Collaborative, what does that do?
So there are perinatal quality collaboratives across the country, in each state is what we're working towards. And what PQCs do is focus on advancing evidence-based, data-driven initiatives involving our hospitals and communities to implement what we know are best practices in usually a time-limited fashion. So what we're trying to do is getting all of our hospitals to implement those interventions that we know are effective, and working collaboratively in a way that tracks data and uses quality improvement science to spread those interventions and bring them to scale and hopefully drive those improvements in a faster way. We know there can be solutions to certain maternal and infant conditions, but that spread is not always very quick. And what the MSPQC and perinatal quality collaboratives do across the country is really try to work collaboratively to bring those solutions across every state hospital.
Yeah, because I was just wondering, in places where, for a whole variety of reasons, access to healthcare gets ever more difficult, you know, in rural communities, for example, that, you know, how Sarah was talking earlier about while you're in the hospital setting, that's one thing, but then you go home and you can largely be, if not entirely on your own, feeling like you don't have that infrastructure around you anymore. That certainly must be an issue for some of the families that you work with.
Yes, that's a huge issue in Mississippi. We have only a handful of neonatal intensive care unit hospitals in the state are level 3 or higher hospitals. We only have one level 4 facility. There are fewer than 20 maternal fetal medicine specialists in the entire state. It is not uncommon for women to have to drive or families to have to drive over an hour to see an obstetric provider, and that's a general obstetric provider. So certainly when it comes to the follow-up care that a mom or family may need, it is very difficult to bring those services, even the ones we know work. It's how do you get it to every family across the state, and that is a big challenge in Mississippi.
Dr. Collier, I just want to be sure I heard you correctly, that in the entire state of Mississippi, there are roughly 20 fetal-maternal health specialists?
Maternal-fetal medicine specialists
in all of Mississippi.
Correct.
So there, just in that number, it underscores the disparities here, because I want to acknowledge I'm sitting here in a studio in Boston, and I can guarantee you, like, in any one of the number of hospitals that I can walk to from here, there are more than 20 specialists of that in that one hospital.
Yes. And that really gets to part of the struggle when we're trying to bring interventions to scale, when we're trying to do the research to understand what's going on. Every clinician in Mississippi is working hard taking care of women, and you don't have that volume of providers, of experts, of researchers who can dedicate that time and energy the same way that someplace like Boston has those resources available. So it's a real challenge.
To say the least, I think you're being very balanced about it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is. It's difficult to recruit providers here. You can understand we only have most of those 20 are concentrated in the urban centers. But to build up the resources and facilities in a small rural hospital, it's nearly impossible. So we do have to start looking at technology like telemedicine and how we can try to overcome what seems to be this insurmountable challenge of both getting more doctors here. But with that said, I don't necessarily just believe it's going to be more maternal fetal medicine specialists. We need more midwives in the state of Mississippi. We need nurse practitioners and providers of women who are local to women and families and can provide that kind of care that's compassionate and is going to overcome those challenges that women face, that when it comes to social or economic stressors. And I strongly believe that having more local midwives and doulas could do a lot to help with our problems here in Mississippi. It's not just going to be on the higher end of technology or subspecialist care.
Right. Well, Sarah, isn't this exactly why you make the point that understanding the rates of premature birth in the United States, it's an overall indicator. It's one of those indicators of overall quality of health and healthcare in America.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started reporting the book, Cindy Pellegrini, who was a senior vice president for public policy at March of Dimes, said something really memorable to me. She said, the premature birth rate can be understood as a canary in a coal mine. So you can, if those numbers are going up, there is something wrong. You can use the prematurity rates can be a lens and a way of understanding the health of a given community. It's the same for individuals who have had negative birth outcomes, you know, in pregnancy, people who have had complications like I had who have had preeclampsia are more likely to go on to have cardiovascular disease. It's sort of a window into – it reveals something about your health that may not otherwise have been revealed until later. And for communities and for populations, it can be understood the same way. It's a window into the health of a community. And you know that if the prematurity rate in a given community is going up, it means that the people who are birthing in that community, their health is on decline. Mm-hmm. And understanding the reasons that might be is really important so that we can target those problems and you know, give those communities justice, give them better care. So they can have healthier babies and healthier lives. Yeah. That's really important.
Well, let's quickly go to a call before we run out of time in this segment. So Anna's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, my name again is Anna, and I run a nonprofit here in Baltimore that supports Black women specifically with the NICU experience. And I just wanted to echo some of the information that your guests have already spoken about around the disparity and around the need for actual implicit bias training and us having the conversation around race. What we're seeing in the hospitals here in Baltimore is that our families, our moms are not feeling supported completely. They're not feeling like they're being listened to. And those things are affecting care, right? They're affecting the trust of those that are supposed to be taken care in the hospital, and also impacting the mental health, because if you're recovering from an emergency C-section or an emergency delivery, that's one level of trauma. But then if you're also stuck in the hospital or you're afraid to leave your baby and all of these other things, and then you don't trust those who are taking care of your child because they have demonstrated in one way, shape, or form that they are not listening to you or they are discounting you because of maybe something that you're perceiving as your race or discrimination or bias, that makes it increasingly hard to really navigate these experiences in the NICU, especially after having maybe a negative experience during pregnancy and facing these same things that we all can say and name are happening to Black women in pregnancy and in the postpartum.
Yeah. And if I just might jump in here, because we only have about a minute before we have to take a quick break. But let me ask you, given what you've said, what kind of additional supports would best help these moms?
So here in Baltimore, Mom Cares, we support moms by giving direct service, so helping with transportation, sitting by the bedside, being a doula. So we do that emotional support by the bedside, but also being that extra voice and that extra accountability when doctors and nurses and support staff are addressing the parents. Mm. But also making sure that, you know, if mom needs help getting transportation, if she has any of these environmental stressors that she needs help with, helping connect her with those things, but also being an extra ear and accountability person in the NICU while they're caring for their young children.
Yeah. Well, Anna in Baltimore, Maryland, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Well, let's just take a quick break here. There's a lot more to discuss when we come back. We are talking about the history and future around care with premature births. My guests today are Sarah DiGregorio. She's author of Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. Dr. Charlene Collier also joins us. She's director of the Mississippi Perinatal Quality Collaborative. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Sarah DiGregorio. She's author of the new book, Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. We're also joined by Dr. Charlene Collier. She's with us from Jackson, Mississippi. She's director of the Mississippi Perinatal Quality Collaborative. She's an OBGYN and associate professor at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And let's go right back to the phones. Let's go to Erin, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Erin, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Go ahead.
Just wanted to mention that a lot of times women don't know necessarily if they're even prone to have a premature delivery. I had two early deliveries. My water broke at 31 weeks, and I ended up having him at 32 weeks. Luckily, we had done the steroid shot knowingly because my daughter was premature as well. Mm. So that kind of got him a little good jump start. But like my mom says, she works 30 years as a respiratory therapist in the NICU. He had little wimpy white boy syndrome, and his last name was White. And I was like, he's going to be in there forever. We didn't know that my body just didn't want to be pregnant. I like being pregnant. I love being pregnant. I love my babies. My body just didn't want to be pregnant. And there was no way necessarily to know. But luckily, you know, the doctors here in Columbia, my OBGYN, were able to at least address, as soon as they knew something was going to happen, to protect me and my son.
Mm-hmm.
But I was 30 years old. And went into, you know, and I cheered in college. I cheered in the NFL.
Uh-huh.
I was active. I was healthy. There was no way necessarily to say, because you did something, you're going to have a preemie.
Yeah.
And my mom, again, has worked 30 years in the NICU. And she was like, keep them in. For every day you have them in, it's 3 days out of the NICU, you know.
Well, Erin, if I may, you actually said some really interesting things there that I want to get our guests' impressions on. So thank you so much for that call. Sarah, Erin used the phrase, like, not that she was, but, like, our Is there any evidence that women can be, quote unquote, prone to premature birth? Is there any genetic component at all?
Yeah, so I want to make a distinction. There is likely a genetic component to premature birth. It doesn't explain the racial disparity.
Right,
there's
right.
no reason to believe it explains the racial disparity. But yes, there is a genetic component, and some people are having given birth early one time does mean that you are at higher risk for giving birth early in subsequent pregnancies. And that can be for a lot of different reasons. But yes, I mean, it certainly does have a genetic component. Researchers are still looking into that. I mean, in my own family, my grandfather was early. I was actually early as well. And then my daughter was early. So, you know, I don't know exactly why that happened, but and, you know, as your caller said, she didn't have any reason to believe that that would happen to her, and then it did. And something like 50% of premature births are medically unexplained. We don't know why. Mm-hmm. We don't know why they happen.
Mm. Dr. Collier, I was just wondering if I could get your professional view here on this question of is there a genetic component to this?
Well, as Sarah mentioned, it's not conclusive, and it's certainly not something that's actionable,
mm-hmm.
Something we can identify in a woman who hasn't had a prior preterm birth and do a blood test and let her know that. We're mostly basing upon history. Have you had a prior preterm birth and you are at risk for having one again? And asking that family history, if the woman herself was born preterm, there is a higher risk of her also being born preterm. But it's extremely, again, difficult to tease apart genetics and environment, and the where you've grown up, your family history is completely tied to where, you know, the environment you've come up in. So it may still remain extremely difficult to have a relevance about that genetic history. We're not really dealing with those environmental factors as well.
Yeah, good point. Well, so I just want to switch gears here a tiny bit, and Sarah, ask you about this question of how have these questions around care and medicine for premature births changed as we can take care of infants that are born earlier and earlier, right? I mean, you said your daughter was 28 weeks?
28 weeks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so at how many weeks earlier now can a baby be born and thrive after NICU care?
So right now in the United States, what we think of as quote unquote viability, and when people say viability, I think maybe sometimes we have the impression that that means some kind of biological marker, or you know, you cross the line and now you can live outside the uterus. In reality, viability is resource specific. It's to some extent culture specific.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the medical care available as much as any kind of characteristic of the baby. So right now in the United States, babies born between 22 and 24 weeks are considered to have a chance. So 22 weeks is really the earliest that any hospital would feel that it was ethical to intervene in terms of resuscitating the baby at birth and attempting to treat them in the NICU. And these questions are very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are – treating 22-week babies is something that was very rare 10 years ago and is now – it is the numbers suggest that more and more babies are being offered active NICU care at 22 weeks. And one interesting factor around this is that different hospitals offer different options
mm-hmm.
at 22, 23 weeks, mostly because they, even though they are all reading the same data, there's a difference of opinion about whether or not that, you know, that is a good thing or not. NICU care is, you know, it's very intense. It can be uncomfortable. It can be painful. And no one wants to subject a baby to that without any hope of having a future. So that question, sort of that where that edge lies, is a question that neonatologists really have to wrestle with. And in terms of explaining that to parents and offering them those choices.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Collier, is this a question you've had to wrestle with in your practice?
Oh, absolutely. And as Sarah mentioned, it wasn't long ago that we were not even attempting to offer resuscitation below 24 weeks or 500 grams of weight. And the NICU technology and that aspect of care has advanced to the point that we are able to, but it does not mean that it's a very easy discussion with families. And trying to explain the path that they have ahead is very difficult, and I think Sarah can touch upon that, is trying to hear what risks your baby may face in being in the NICU, the complications they may face, and the long-term complications, how will that baby be if they do survive to be a child, the kind of disabilities they may face are very real and, again, very difficult for a mom to grasp. In that moment, she will do anything to save her baby's life. There's nothing that a provider can say about the risks that may happen that will make most moms, at least many of the women I care for here, decide not to do everything possible. So it is a real challenge and becomes a very heartbreaking situation for everyone involved when that resuscitation isn't successful.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, did you want to add more?
Yeah, to echo what Dr. Collier said, what I hear in my interviews and reporting with mothers and with clinicians, that really overwhelmingly, when parents hear that there is any chance, they really want to do whatever it is that will give their baby a chance. And I think that is a very powerful thing that should be respected. Research has shown that clinicians tend to, because I think clinicians have a very heavy sense of responsibility. They do see the worst possible scenarios. And so there can be a dynamic where clinicians, tend to feel more pessimistic about certain outcomes than parents do. Parents often will say to me, no matter what kind of disability my child might have, I want my child.
Mm-hmm. But can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
Because,
mm-hmm.
At what stage will the infants mandatorily go into NICU care? 25, 26 weeks?
Yeah, about 25. It depends on the hospital, but about 25 weeks it's considered mandatory. It's in the best interest of the infant.
Are there ever any cases where the parents don't want that?
I think it's rare. Okay. I know it does. Anecdotally, I've heard some clinicians have told me that does happen, but usually I think that communication, and again, this is anecdotal, communication between parents and clinicians, I think, has gotten better over maybe the last 20 years. I think that the idea of shared decision making and really bringing parents in, and when parents have reservations, really taking the time to sit down with them and explain to them, what this is going to involve, that this can be an ongoing conversation, that things might change, that if, certain things happen, that the conversation might change. If a baby has a bilateral grade 4 brain bleed, that the conversation might change, but that this can be sort of an ongoing communication. So yes, there are situations where there is conflict between clinicians and parents in multiple ways around these very difficult decisions around viability.
Mm-hmm. Before I run out of time here, I want to just get at least one or two more calls if I can. So let's go to Kelsey, who's calling from Lancaster, Wisconsin. Kelsey, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and for discussing this important topic. I just wanted to touch on the complications that you were speaking of that can arise after the fact. So I have a 25-weeker who is now 2 years old, And because we lived so far away from medical care for him, and because of the complications we saw him face in the NICU, I ended up developing PTSD. And I'm just wondering if you can speak to those challenges that moms can face coming home.
Yeah. Kelsey, thank you so much for that. And I'm sorry you had to go through that. But Dr. Collier, I mean, the mental health needs of mothers in experiencing something like this.
Yes, this is very critical, and I will say that I think, sadly, once the baby's out, so much attention turns on to the baby. The mom is no longer pregnant. She's not at risk of a preterm delivery anymore, and so much attention goes on to the baby that I think, on whole, moms are forgotten in many ways. And sadly, in a state like Mississippi, where 65% of the births are to women on Medicaid, their health care is gone at 6 weeks. Even if they develop a mental health condition, we can't continue that support and care. So this really ties into identifying these problems, screening moms early in the NICU. And NICUs do a great job with having social workers, having support care and services available to moms that are present. But as the caller pointed out, getting to that NICU may be very difficult, particularly if a mother has to get back to work or has other children. So these wraparound services, these services or moms are so critical, and they need to be localized where people are living. And we need to think about our health policies to ensure that moms have access to health care and insurance beyond that early period.
Right. Dr. Collier, you've just mentioned a bunch of really important things, right? Like, frequently mothers have to go back to work, they don't have maternal leave, or transportation issues, just getting back and forth from home to the hospital if the hospital's far away. I mean, maternal health and infant health are so multifactorial, especially for the families that you serve. I'm just wondering, not to say that there is a magic wand, but what are one or two things that we could be doing to make a real positive impact here?
Well, starting with those policies, I do think that paid maternal leave is critical, family leave, so families can take care of their babies and take care of themselves without having to worry about their finances as much. So that is a policy we as a country should support, that we don't support. And when we look at our differences to us and other developed nations, that's one of the major differences, is how families are supported with paid leave. Thinking about that medical and Medicaid expansion through that first year postpartum and then beyond, so that moms can and families can receive that health care. And then in the midst of the pregnancy, looking at models of care like group prenatal care, where we're really providing more than just medical services. We're looking at those wraparound services, that social support, dealing with those social issues that are really underpinning a lot of the health problems that we see.
Mm. Well, Sarah DeGregorio, we've got about a minute and a half left. This has gone by very quickly. I'm just looking at the subtitle of your book about what this is all teaching us about being human. I'm wondering, after experiencing this yourself and raising your daughter and doing this research, what has it taught you about being human?
Yeah, it's funny. Speaking quickly, what really it has done, I have a much richer understanding now. It has really just brought up more questions. And for me, some of the questions are, how can we as a society protect the most vulnerable among us? How can we move towards being a society that recognizes that childbirth and child rearing are not things that individuals can do alone? And so those were some of the big questions that just became more vivid to me as I understood better what had happened to us and what happens to 1 in 10 families. And I really also felt very strongly that the NICU is this place that the curtain is kind of pulled back on, this thing that you're not supposed to see, that this, the really the beauty of a human being built, and the fact that all these babies are building these very, very really the parts of their brains that make them human, and sort of the ability to be able to be with them during that time was felt very powerful to me.
Well, Sarah DiGregorio's new book is Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
And Dr. Charlene Collier, she's director of the Mississippi Perinatal Quality Collaborative and an associate professor at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Dr. Collier, it was a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.